Sanctify them through the truth. Thy word is true. You know, which is absolutely right. Doesn't refer to the sermon. Doesn't even refer to the Bible. Refers to Jesus Christ. Head on. That's kind of neat. The Bible, I think, I don't know, 187, almost 200 times, refers to the Word. Never once refers, when it says Word, does it refer to itself. Talking about the Gospel, the message of Jesus Christ, constantly, over and over and over again. When it refers to itself, it uses another term, Scripture. Scripture. So, the Word made flesh. The Bible, the chronology of, the story of, the message of how that Word was enfleshed, dwelt among us, and worked out the whole salvation program for us. Search the Scriptures. I'm not sure exactly that one passage which we all had to memorize when we were kids. Search the Scriptures, for in them you think you have eternal life, and they are they which testify of me. The more I think about that, the more I think maybe that's a sort of an admonition to search the Scriptures, but in them ye think ye have eternal life seems almost like a challenge, that maybe the eternal life is not in the Scriptures, but in the God about which Scriptures is all about. So the Bible, an incredible gift, and we can't let it alone. It is our best source and our best resource. And the theme this morning is hands. Hands. I guess she talked about all the different hand concepts in that poem by Herb Brokering. Quite a. Any of you know Herb? He spent some time up here. Some of you should get to know him. And the way he's been traveling around the country, he's bumped into an awful lot of people. And he gets on these little word kicks and just kind of runs them all over the place. And this morning it was hand, and it was God's hand, the hand that changes water into wine, the hand that feeds 5,000 with loaves and fishes, and our hands. One of the best things I've seen about hands is Ernie Zorb's little slide presentation. He hasn't given that since we've been up here. I hope he hasn't lost the slides, but he has a little slide thing called Holding Hands.
And, I'd like to see that.
Yeah, and it's really kind of neat. And he's got all the hands of Holden, but of course the Holden Hands is one of Ernie's typical jokes. But all the hands, the hand at the potter's wheel, the hands of folks weaving and sewing and making things, the hands of kids clapping while they're playing their games, the hands of benediction after the service in the morning. Hands, one of the great ways in which we reach each other. And yet, this poem, if you can remember, it was spoken kind of softly. You really had to listen hard. But it said something to the effect that, you know, when a word is not available, when a, you know, to speak to one another, that very often just the hands will do that. And I kind of would like to know how that works. That's true. It's true. But if you know, every now and then you want to, I know, particularly in times of grief. Mm-hmm. You know, I think especially when you try, You've all gone through this. In fact, you've experienced it much more than I have. We lost a son, born with half a heart, lived for 2 days, shouldn't have lived at all. And it makes you wonder, you know, that's one of God's little jokes, you know, why he allowed Stephen to live for 2 days. There was no way that little kid with half a heart was going to survive. He shouldn't have survived birth. But so he just gave him to you long enough for you to want him bad, you know, and then he took him away. And that's, you know, people, what do you say at a time like that? And when we have had experiences of trying to figure out what to say for other people at times like that, you know how you rehearse in your mind? Mm-hmm. How you walk around for back and forth a little bit, or you're on your way over to the funeral parlor and you walk real slow and you try and say, now what I'm going to say, Harry, God needed her now. No, that doesn't sound right. I'm going to say, Harry, she sure was a wonderful woman. Oh no, my gosh, that's terrible. You go through all of this stuff in your mind as you're, you know, you've got to write this letter. You know, how do you find a word? And wouldn't you really rather, instead of having to find the words for these things, wouldn't you rather just go to her and just touch her? Just lay a hand on her, and then all of a sudden, you know, whatever it is you wanted to say, it's said. I hate telephones. I will go to any lengths to avoid a telephone. I hate to answer the telephone. I think I maybe even hate to answer one more than I hate to call on one. A year in Africa was so neat. I had to walk 2.5 miles just, you know, to do a thing that I would have had to, could have, but it was neat because you could gesture. You know, if I had a phone in Africa, I wouldn't have known what to do with it anyway. I mean, I pick up the phone and here's this strange, what is this on the phone? You know, I'm sorry, I don't speak the language. Bye, and hang up. But if I went, I could gesture. I taught for a year art school at a German Academy of Fine Art, you know, with only 8 weeks of German. And this was an institute of art, and all of it was hands. That's neat about art. You can say so much with hands. I couldn't speak until I was 17 years old. And up to that time, that's why I got into art. It was like I was making pictures. But more than that, I could say what I wanted and what I needed and how I felt just by using hands. And some of it was sign language. But the interesting thing to me is that the hand business, if you want to say something and instead you use the hand, and somehow a hand can say something, doesn't it really just say something to people who have already spoken to one another, who already know how the other person feels? I wonder if in an hour of deep agony, you know, I wonder what message you would get from a total stranger who put a hand on you as compared with someone that you've lived with all your life. The message would be different. I think it would, you would understand the feeling, the words coming through just the touch of the hand as being different from someone you know. It's like, who is the lady at breakfast this morning who's here without her family for a weekend, you know, and she said she wanted to go down to Koinonia and just ask for one of the kids to hug her. she's missing her kids, you know. She got her kids and her husband at home, and she sees all these little kids, and Matthew, our boy, was sitting across from her this morning, and Matthew was pouring sugar on top of his shredded wheat like there was going to be no sugar tomorrow. And it was just, and I said, Matthew, come, that's enough. But he said, but I like it. I said, Matthew, that's enough sugar. And this poor lady who had left her children and her husband at home said, oh, that is so beautiful. And she was getting a little bleary-eyed. She said, I just got to go down to Koinonia and ask one of those little kids to hug me, you know, because she needs those hands. But the hands that you get, you know, you can take peanut butter and jelly on your skirt, I would imagine, you mamas, from your own kid. A strange kid come up and wipe his peanut butter and jelly on you, that is another message altogether, right? Isn't it? Huh? Yeah, sure it is. Sure it is. So the touch thing, to me, seems to always imply that there has been a sort of understood message. As somebody who's in the art thing, I never understood it at first, but the older I get, the more I'm understanding that this nonverbal sort of thing is really never a substitute. It's really never to take the place of the word that you give to one another. That's why scripture is so important. You know, that a whole Bible that was just nothing but pictures. That would be so dangerous, I think, so tricky. And I'm going through all four Gospels right now. Word by word, and sticking pictures into these formats, but the word somehow has to be there. I sort of feel that if you can lay your hands on somebody but not give them a word because you just don't know what to say, that that's actually what's happened. You don't know how you feel if you can't give a word to it. I'm not saying that it isn't a feeling, maybe a very profound feeling. But if you can't give a word to it, you probably don't know what the feeling is. That the evidence of your understanding what you are feeling really manifests itself in being able to say what it is you feel. Now that's a hard, for me that's hard. Because I deal with just visual, the making of images continually, and have very little practice. I mean, a whole 17 years without saying a word, and very little practice at putting these words together, you know. But I kind of believe that if you know what you feel, it's like, how we get that from kids in the university. Oh, I know, I just can't say it, you know. And that usually comes at the bottom of a test page. Right? I know the answer to this just as well as I know my name. I just can't put it into words. You know. No, I got a hunch they don't know. They really don't know. Sometimes the knowing can only manifest itself in fumbling around, maybe very uncomfortably. It may be a searching, but the hand is never a substitute for saying a word. It may be the best you got at a given time, so don't keep your hands behind your back. Oh, I think of Eucharist. Oh, you know, take, eat, take, drink. Well, some of you, it was hard Sunday, because most of us, I think, the way I was growing up, my father was my pastor, and I was growing up, and we sort of had to have our hands down. And he did pastor did all the work. But when we say, take, eat, take, drink, and people reach out, and they grab that cup, and they hold out their hands for the bread, you know. Hands are really good ways of getting people to help you, and getting you to help people. But always, shock of all shocks, to put a piece of bread in somebody's hand and have this little girl look up and say, thanks.
Well, you don't say thanks. You know, this is quiet time. This is just put that in your mouth. That's all you're supposed to do. But say thanks. You know, it's one little simple word, and it meant a whole different kind of relationship.
Hand.
Put in a word here on the practice in the old Norwegian Lutheran Church. That's where Steve takes that statement right after reading the words.
Yeah, right.
Always the. But I recall one time, at that time, the practice was always of absolution with the placing of the hands on the communicant,
mm-hmm.
and then the distribution. And one old man said, when they were under discussion, that maybe they would omit that, it took time, and they would just pronounce it. And one old fellow said, well, if they stop putting hands on my head, then it won't be worthwhile to go to communion.
Ah. You
know, poor doctrinally, but was saying something about this use of hands.
Of how important it is. And when Carol is up here, I don't know, a lot of things happen differently when Carol's up here. he has a thing that goes on from time to time. It's rather ad hoc, no particular schedule, but a laying on of hands service, usually late at night after the day's festivities are over. And I tell you, from my experience, both in assisting with the pronouncing of a prayer, as well as just being one of those that has a hand put on them, it is a special moment. It is a special time. Every now and then, when I am asked to do blessing with Carol, to lay my hands on someone's head and not say anything, and I find that it's wrong. Not for me, it's wrong. That I'm sure they would understand. That I'm running out of words, you know. Or I would like to say something very personal. I'd like to, you know, you lay your hands and you look down there and you see who you've got. See, who's underneath there? And you say, oh, yeah, Martha. Hi, evening, Martha. And we say a special prayer or blessing directed specifically at Martha. Martha's got a problem this evening, Lord, and this is what it is, and we'd like, you know, help Martha not be afraid and give her joy in the morning and that kind of thing. And the last time this happened, I hadn't done it in a year. And the last year when I put my hand on people's heads, it was a rather nice, quiet, sort of formal thing. This last time, I wound up with a bunch of kids in a row, staffers, and every one of them, as I laid my hand on their head, reached up and put their hand on top of mine, and just pushed, you know, just pulled down, and it was just incredible. So communication can really definitely come through the hand, and special ways. I think we are doing more of it now than we used to. People are not as afraid to touch.
I would like to share something about a brother-in-law of mine. I have a wonderful brother-in-law. Both of them are great, but especially this one. In the first place, I'm glad that we're shaking hands again.
Mm.
There for 10, 20 years, we lost the art of shaking hands.
Mm.
But we've come back to that. But my brother-in-law, Lloyd, he's not so wordy. As you say, words probably should follow the hand act, but he isn't that wordy. But on Sunday mornings especially, he's very demonstrative in a quiet way, and he'll go up to any one of the many widows in church. Well, how are you today, Mrs.
Yeah.
Well, how are you today, Mrs. Yack, and so on and so forth. And this is just Lloyd's way of doing it. And that are here that know my brother-in-law Lloyd knows that he has no ulterior motives behind any of these things. He's just real genuine in this. And then a couple of the widows, and these are widow ladies.
Mm-hmm.
We have many widows in the world, as we all know. And a couple of the widows came to to my sister and said, Vi, you'll never know how much Lloyd's arm around me meant to me this morning.
Yeah.
I haven't felt that since Bob died or since Dan died.
Mm-hmm.
And she told Lloyd this.
Yeah.
You don't know what a service you're actually doing.
Yeah.
Just by grabbing him a hold of the arms and pulling right to the wall. How are you today?
Yeah.
And pretty soon he's to the next one. And it's really great.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. People really need that. And sometimes you sort of feel that the Lord is, the Lord has given me a special handshake. And it's because I got bursitis in this elbow. I've got a paintbrush elbow. Some of you have tennis elbows and, I don't know, golf elbows. I got a paintbrush elbow. And I got, boy, some guys come along and they squeeze, you know, and boy, it makes my ear ache. Oh, wonderful. You know, and really, we had a fellow who was the director of the Lutheran Hour, and Gene Berman, and this guy would start his handshake from behind his back. He'd come at you and he'd go, good to see you, Rich, you know, and he'd wind up with this big thunderclap right in the middle, you know. You just want to kind of, before you made contact, just go like that and just see if he could spin like a top or something like that. But what after a while, this arm was just, oh, it was terrible. So I got into the habit of, whenever I shake hands, I grab with both. You know, I shake the hand and then I hold the other one at the wrist so I can pull it off. No, it's not so I can pull it off. It's that because I can't squeeze too hard. And so I squeeze with this one. So my handshakes are usually wrist squeezes, you know, with my left hand, and I try and, you know, get at them through both. But you are absolutely right. The touching, or you have found, I'm sure, people that are walking along that are looking like they've just been kicked. Really, you know, really just been kicked, and you will walk up to them and you'll put a hand on them, and all of a sudden it just, they were just waiting for somebody to come and touch them, and your touching them brings forth this dialogue, this way of it's kind of like tapping a tree. You know, then you touch them and some things can come forth. That some way, in some ways, a touch is a way of knocking down a wall that separates people. Yeah, Steve.
Hey, Rich, I want to share with you an experience that I had my first year in the ministry. I was in a mission field up in Canada. And apparently this fellow had his right hand cut off in an accident, so he had a hook. And I saw him coming in the line when I was shaking hands with him on that first Sunday. And so when I came to him, I put out my left hand. And we shook hands with our left hand. And that fellow never forgot.
Yeah.
He said, you made me feel comfortable for the first time.
Yeah.
So I didn't have to reach around like this with my right hand.
Yeah.
And that fellow never forgot that left handshake.
Acknowledging him as a whole person.
Yeah, that's right. And I think we can do that so often to people as we touch them.
Yeah, it is a way of communicating. It also takes the same kind of thoughtfulness that communication really ought to take. I think a lot of us talk too much. You know, I am finding out very slowly that one of the best signs of wisdom is when you are growing tired of the sound of your own voice. You know, you just want, as you grow older, to measure your words as well as your days. You know, so that what comes out is important. And every now and then you wind up with people who don't use their hands
in a kind of, well, they're just slapping everybody all over the place, you know, and you almost want to duck because you know that you're just another back to be slapped. And so when a thing like this comes, you get prepared for how you deal with one another physically just the same way as you get, as you prepare yourself with your words. It takes care, it takes concern, and sometimes, like in this case, Steve, you'd have to be awfully quick, you know. I think I would wind up kind of fumbling around, you know, wondering how to shake hands with a hook, you know. It's the most logical, reasonable thing to do, but it is a demonstration of concern. Yeah, beautiful.
Now, you've been talking hands, and I've been thinking, if we all held hands, would we get any better communication?
We might get sweat. For me, you get sawdust this morning. I've been helping my wife make a loom, but you're right. You know, when we did the Lord, the Apostles' Creed last night, I was having trouble with the eyes. I don't know how did you feel? Did you really look square? I was really having trouble. One of the problems is when you look in the eyes, you forget the words. Because a look is really strong, and a direct look makes you forget the words. So we held hands. We held hands while we did it, and then we didn't have to look at each other in the eye. We had some kind of contact there. I saw some people putting their hand on other people's shoulders. And very often, a hand holding is a way in which people don't have to... When I was courting my wife, you know, her eyes just wiped me out. Oh my God, it's big. You know, and so we hold hands, and I didn't have to look at, you know. Ever watch kids holding hands? And, you know, they're sending messages in other ways. You know, it's really kind of neat.
If you call on someone who is seriously ill or in a coma, I think one always ought to take the hand, even just talking briefly and in prayer. I recall the first time I encountered a person in a coma. The wife told me there'd been no communication at all. And I took his hand and prayed briefly. First I tried to talk and there was no evidence of recognition. And then when I took his hand and prayed briefly, his fingers slowly closed on my hand, and I knew it had gone through.
There are a number of ways of speaking with people who can't speak, with the deaf, and also with people who are not only deaf but blind. And we had to learn. One was of course sign language, but that's for sighted deaf. But there's another language that you learn for people who are also blind, and that's by pronouncing the words into the palm. And for a couple of us who learned the sign language for sighted people, we also learned this palm language, and we found it very, very meaningful, much more meaningful to speak to one another in the palm language, even though you could see, to go up to a person you knew was deaf, take them by the hand, and then just talk to them in their palm, and then just look at the expression on their face. It's just marvelous. Absolutely right. That to go to a person who is in really deep need, and take them by the hand, very important. Yeah, Steve?
Rich, you mentioned about looking somebody in the eye when you're talking to them, you forget what you're going to say. I'll never forget our homiletics professor at the seminary, when he was teaching us something about preaching. He says, now when you get in the pulpit, never pick out anybody in the audience and look them in the eye. He says, you'll forget what you're going to say.
Right.
But he says, when you talk to people, whether it's from the pulpit or anyplace else, look at the bridge of their nose or the forehead, and they'll think you're looking them in the eye. I thought that was pretty good advice.
That's absolutely good advice. It took a while for it to sink in to me, but you know, after 18 years of teaching, and you have some of these classes which are, you know, 250 and they're just huge things. Eye contact is absolutely essential, but it's the kiss of death. I mean, it is impossible for you to get the respect of people who, you know, while your head is down there and you're reading from your 10-year-old notes, you know, that's just absolutely, you've got to lift up your face and deal with people. And there was a French artist of a couple years ago who said the entire world is located at the bridge of the nose. The entire world. And I have found that if I'm not coming across to people, if they're not getting my meaning, that the eye isn't the clue of whether it's working or not. It's the bridge of the nose. So I can avoid direct eye contact, and I can also find out whether or not I'm making any sense. It's not just that I want to look at the bridge of the nose so that I can avoid eye contact. It's that is where the message is going in, and whether they're telling me whether, you know, if it's received or not. So I can avoid direct eye contact, and I can also find out whether or not I'm making any sense. It's not just that I want to look at the bridge of the nose so that I can avoid eye contact. It's that is where the message is going in, and whether they're telling me whether, you know, if it's received or not. Yeah.
You know, the eyes of Jesus must have been very penetrating, because in one place it says, and he looked at Peter.
Yeah.
And Peter went out and wept.
Yeah. That whole look, though, and this is kind of what I was saying about hands before, that whole look without the words was not just due to any particular unique kind of eye, I mean physical eye. It was everything that those two people had going with themselves that whole night, you know. It was that eye that reminded Peter of his, I'm never going to leave you, Lord. I'm gonna stick with you. It was Peter remembering, you know, that Jesus said before the cock crows, you're going to deny me thrice. And it was all of that. And, yeah, the eyes of Jesus. That's been my life's work, trying to locate the eyes of Jesus. And it's a fool's errand. It's really a fool's errand.
Rich, maybe you can help me out with something I haven't been able to figure out. Why is it that when we most want that arm around our shoulder, we've got our hands so deep in our own pockets?
Oh, beautiful. Yeah.
I mean, it seems the more we want the arm around the shoulder, you know, the closer to our side we have our own. Like somehow the miracle's got to come from without and touch our lives. I've never been able to figure that out. So maybe your wisdom can help me.
No, that's I think we're all that way. I think that's where we're all at. The reason for the hand going into the pocket is sort of the reason for with it is the symbol, the sign of removing yourself from community. It's
find that in your cabin.
Yeah. No. No.
Loosen up.
Yeah, they're throwing arms all over. Yeah.
So we're inhibited then. Are we?
Are you proposing a cure?
No. Well, yeah, our cure is Christ. That's it. We're so inhibited, I'm so afraid that somebody's saying something about us or having an ulterior motive. We're so afraid of ourselves.
Well, and we were talking about this, a couple of staffers and myself, yesterday. It's like, you know, you're supposed to love each other as yourself. And that implies knowing how much you are worth. I mean, it is hard. It's impossible to love someone else if you really don't feel that you yourself are lovable.
Yeah, sometimes I feel like I don't love anybody, nobody loves me.
That's right. Those two go together. Those two fit very, very close together. That if you sort of, if you have any concept, any idea whatsoever that you are not lovable, that you are not worth being loved, there is no way, you've got nothing to work with. You've got no raw material to go out and say, I love you. You know, that's just not possible. So I would have a hunch that a reason for hands in pockets comes from whatever clues you read, whatever signs and signals you're getting, that you just are not worth being the source of affection, of love. And of course, and as Christian folks, we've got only one signal that we really need to look at, and that's the cross. That's Christ hanging on the cross. That's the affirmation of our creatureliness. It's also the affirmation that we are loved, that we are lovable. You know, and that's the raw material. That's the source out of which we are able to go to one another and love each other. Because we have been loved. We continue to be loved. We are being supported continually in this body of Christ. And it's like from baptism, you know. we hang on the cross and Christ is here. You know, we don't have to go there. I mean, that whole thing has been taken care of. We are living in this eternal life promise. In baptism, and the hand of the Father is on us in blessing continually every morning, a new kind of blessing. If you can understand somehow that then you have been blessed by love in order to be a blessing for other people.
But what I'm reading right now is by Dr. Jess Lehrer. And it's, I ain't much, baby, but I'm all I've got.
Yeah.
And I'm reading a chapter right now about the hardest thing for you to do will be to go out and tell five people, I love you.
Yeah, yeah. You can't do that if you believe that you are all you got, though. I don't see how that's possible. If you yourself are all you got, then you're going to have a hard time telling people that, you know, anybody, even those that love you very much, that you love them in return.
Don't we oftentimes confuse love with a state of emotion? And so you would have to feel, if you went out and said that to five people, you'd have to have a strong feeling for them.
Yeah.
Whereas Christian love is the choice to act toward a person with kindness and readiness to serve.
Yeah, yeah.
And then sometimes feelings may come with it. I'd like to, Rich, to go back to your abhorrence of telephone calls. I've had great sport talking sometimes to utter strangers and then trying to decipher what kind of person that is by the voice.
Yeah.
And you can really have a lot of fun.
Oh, boy. Oh. It can be a game that could get you into trouble. I was born with a silver foot in my mouth, my father says, but I for example, can pick up the phone, and when somebody says, "Hi, Rich, how are you?" I know it's the insurance salesman. you try and sound like the telephone operator and tell him he's got the wrong number or something real quick, you know, because you're broke and you can't afford any more insurance, and you know it's a good thing, and he's going to give you this whole Lutheran Brotherhood thing, you know, or the car dealer that says it's time to come in, or worst of all, the secretary to the dentist.
Oh!
Hello, Dr. Kemmerer. It's the 29th. And you're, oh, it's the 29th. I gotta go in and do all that. And pretty soon you have people who sound like people that you don't really want to hear, you know. Oh, we do the same thing visually. Exactly the same thing visually. Have you ever sat in an airport terminal waiting for a flight and watching people and saying, "Now that is your typical businessman going right there. Look at that, the whole outfit, that face belongs to the, that woman is a member of the local woman's club. If I ever saw a woman's club lady, there she goes," you know, and you know, you begin to affiliate faces with types and voices with types. Pretty soon you've got everybody figured out and there aren't any surprises left. And that's a shame. You wanted to share something with us this morning, didn't you?
Yes.
About community and...
Well, it's... sort of that way. It might not fit in exactly to what you've been saying, but this book was written by Shirley Booth, the singer's wife. Yes. If you probably you don't know that they've gone from religion to non-religion back to religion, and all of their family now sing nothing but religious songs. She says, in part that I've picked out here, is very poignant to me. "I know who I am at last. I'm Shirley Boone, a child of the King. And I know who you can be. Isn't it really identity we're looking for? Look at the masses and the communication media these days in the movies and a TV, almost anything goes if it gets a laugh, or if it's done in the way of art, or if it's done in realty. Our emotions are being changed. Things that should shock us, or at least concern us, don't. We're becoming apathetic. We need guidance. We need direction and balance in this world instead of limitless extremes. Man has come to feel he can solve his problems all by himself. But look what a mess we're making of things. This nation was founded under God, and look how he blessed it. Originally, we were a humble people who leaned on him. In God we trust was on our money, and our nation prospered. Now we trust the money more than God, and it's losing its value. We left the Supreme Court rather than the Supreme Court being guide us on prayer in schools. We took prayer out and pop replaced it. The family in healthy society was an institution of love and order, with the man under God, the woman submissive to man, and the children obedient to parents. Then men decided that they didn't need God. Women decided they didn't need men, and children decided they didn't need to respect authority. Now we're seeing the results. The broken homes all across the nation, a rootless, lost generation. We're rapidly heading toward a 50% divorce rate nationally. How do we get it all together again? There is so much talk about free love these days. Well, what they really mean about this is free sex, and there is a big price attached to that. Twisted emotions, unwanted children, VD, epidemics, and so forth. The only free love around that I know about is described in John 3, chapter 3,
16.
That's what it said, but I didn't know how to express it. "For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. I used to think that everlasting life started when I died. I was so wrong. It is now an abundant, a fulfilled life. This is all I had to say about that. But I thought that was quite poignant in that respect.
The probably the most interesting thing about that is, in a way, she makes it sound like it's all so terribly new, and it sounds just like what you read in the Old Testament. You know, what she said, we used to put in God, we trust on our money, and now we put our trust in our money, you know, and I mean, it sounds like something that would come from Mount Sinai, you know. You have turned away from me, you know, and my wrath is upon you, and you have been disobedient children. The unfortunate thing about the situation that we are in now in our relationship to God is that we have been in this relationship ever since the fall. We have all turned away and come short of the glory of God. There is very little chance that we give for the reflection of God's work, how he operates in our lives, to manifest itself to other people. I mean, I think who was it, Jim, the other day was saying, you know, you confess God, you live a godly life, somehow it ought to make a difference so that people see this. Look how this works. The glory of the Lord shone round about them. God was visible. What's the next line? And they were sore afraid. Actually, the glory of the Lord is not one of these really neat-looking things, you know, where everybody says, ooh, I want a little piece of that. Because Christ came and he glorified the Father. He made the action of the Father visible. And they killed him for it. Now, we are to glorify him, which likely means we're going to get sat on, that people are going to have to come down on us if we are really doing the will of the Father, if we are really making God visible. It's going to make an awful lot of people uncomfortable. Yes, please.
It seems that when he walked here on earth for 2 years, he did things so simply. But he constantly was in communication with the Father, and that communication with the Father gave him communication with others. And as much as it seemed to hated him and crucified him, all he had to do was to walk down the road and he had crowds following him. Do we ever see him when he didn't have a crowd following him?
Yes.
Or do we ever see him when, or read about him, when someone wasn't after him for something?
Yes.
It seems he had to sneak away for quiet time for himself.
Oh yeah, he did. That's
but,
right.
But it was the simple things, and I think that we try. It seems to me sometimes we try to complicate our living. In what I mean is the simple things. He walked down the road and he saw a need and he dealt with the need right at the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then he walked further and there was another need and he met. So he was in constant communication, and he kept his communication going this way, so it would go this way. And if it was just if we constantly communicate with him, then we too will see what we can do to reflect him to others.
Yeah.
Even though they are probably, like you say, going to come down on us.
Right.
They in turn will. It's going to draw, and they're going to come back. And what is it that you have that I don't have?
We don't even have to worry about that in the long run. I think you know we've maybe got a complex that says the message really makes it if a lot of people listen to it. And I think of Christ's high priestly prayer if you could use that high priestly prayer as the your year end report to synodical headquarters, you'd probably get drummed right out of the church. I mean, this poor guy wound up after all of his ministry with What is a handful? 12 guys, and one of those has gone off and forsaken me, and as soon as I get hung on this cross, the rest of them are going to leave. You got to ask Peter. You going to do it too, Peter? Are you going to leave me too? And Peter says, oh, no, not I. I'll never leave you. Next second, he was gone, and they all went up in the room and locked themselves behind the door. Here is a man alone. He is alone. But you're right, when there was a need, he dealt with it. And somehow the idea of community is sort of messed up. How many people, how many times have you said to yourself, I'd really like to go over and help, but what's she going to say? If I, you know, Jesus was probably the biggest butt-insky you ever saw in your whole life. I mean, can you imagine a guy going up to a woman at the well and says, you know, the man you're living with now isn't your husband. You've been messing around with 5 other guys, you know?
Zacchaeus, I'm coming to your house today.
Yeah, Zacchaeus, right now. Yeah, come on down from the tree and let's go over and get something to eat. Right away. And the lepers...
How many times Jesus really never went out of his way to help anybody, though?
Oh, you don't?
He didn't go out of his way to help them.
We go out of our way to avoid helping people.
On the way.
Yeah.
On the way.
Sure.
Sometimes I think we have to spread ourselves so thinly, scatter ourselves all over, and then we just wear out. It's on the way.
They're right in front of you. Yeah, but we go out of our way to avoid them because we're worried. We're wondering, I'm not competent to help that person. You know, I'm just a layman. Oh, I'm just a layman. Layman is probably one of the dirtiest words in the English language. Layman. It means you don't know nothing. You know? You know? You can, in art, you get a whole bunch of people standing in front of a painting and there's somebody shaking their head. I don't know what it means, but of course I'm just a layman. You know, that is a really poor excuse. I think the church has caused, you know, most of its own people to have absolutely no sense of their own worth by just calling them all laymen.
Our pastor starts his sermon every Sunday morning, fellow ministers.
Beautiful. Absolutely. And one of the things that you are expected to do then is to minister to him. When he says that, he's asking for your help. Yeah.
You're talking about laymen. I got sick in Seattle, so yesterday outside of the church, and I went to a seizure after a service. And I woke up by myself and I'm standing there, my head up pretty good and so forth. And somebody came over and they said, well, we didn't know what to do. You know, and I've seen this in other incidents too. They just pass them up, or they could help a little bit.
Oh yeah. This overwhelming sense of inadequacy.
Yeah.
And I think people, I see it when we build the churches of master craftsmen, of women who are continually sewing and stitching and doing incredible stuff, of men who can handle a lathe and who can do the most beautiful woodwork and build clock cabinets and tables and all kinds, and none of them, first of all, are even asked to make something for the church, or if they were asked, would really feel that what they did was not worthy. Somehow not worthy to be put into the church. That's really a frightening thing. The hands of people, what God gives you to do, you know, in blessing, in communication, in conversation, what God gives you to do, you do that with all your heart. And not be afraid. I was looking up hands in my concordance. Boy, hands, a couple columns worth of hands in here. And I found I found a set in Isaiah. I'd like to just read this to you. The Lord has sent a word against Jacob, and it will light upon Israel. And all the people will know, Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, who say in pride and in arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen, but we will build with dressed stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will put cedars in their place. So the Lord raises adversaries against them and stirs up their enemies. The Syrians on the east and the Philistines on the west devour Israel with open mouth. For all this, his anger is not turned away, and his hand is stretched out still. The people did not turn to him who smote them, nor seek the Lord of hosts. So the Lord cut off from Israel head and tail, palm branch and reed, and one day the elder and honored man is the head, and the prophet who teaches lies is the tail. For those who lead this people lead them astray, and those who are led by them are swallowed up. Therefore the Lord does not rejoice over their young men, and has no compassion on their fatherless and widows. For everyone is godless and an evildoer, and every mouth speaks folly. For all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. For wickedness burns like a fire, it consumes briars and thorns. It kindles the thickets of the forest, and they roll upward in a column of smoke. Through the wrath of the Lord of hosts, the land is burned, and the people are like fuel for the fire. No man spares his brother. They snatch on the right, but are still hungry, and they devour on the left, but are not satisfied. Each devours his neighbor's flesh. Manasseh, Ephraim, and Ephraim, Manasseh, all together they are against Judah. For all this his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. That is incredible. You talk about the time in which we live, all of the things that she was writing about. Sons not listening to fathers, daughters not listening to mothers, families split, the world at enmity against itself. But the hand of the Lord is stretched out still. He is the God of wherever we are. Thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.